Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, April 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Rwanda begins 100-day commemoration to mark the 30th anniversary of the 1994 genocide.
Rwanda's tragedy is a warning. The process of division and extremism, which leads to genocide, can happen anywhere if left unchecked.
Kenyan doctors again reject the government's latest offer to end a nearly month-long strike. Yesterday was World Health Day. Israel marks 6 months since the deadly Hamas attack. Senegal's new president announces a 30-member cabinet, but women feel they are not highly represented.
That itself is a big problem because women were at the forefront in the fight against the third term. Women were at the forefront in trying to protect Sonko and his party.
And millions of people in some parts of the United States will experience a total solar eclipse today, Monday. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's thoughts, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Rwanda has commenced a solemn 100-day period of remembrance, marking three decades since the genocide that claimed about a million lives of mostly Tutsi and some Madre Hutus in 1994. In a commemoration ceremony in Kigali over the weekend, President Paul Kagame called for global solidarity in confronting the ongoing challenges of genocide denial and ethnic populism. Senenu Toro reports from Kigali, Rwanda.
Rwandan President Paul Kagame on Sunday lit a flame of remembrance in the capital, Kigali, to mark 30 years since the genocide that took the lives of nearly a million people. The flame of remembrance will burn for the next 100 days, the number of days that the genocide lasted in 1994. Kagame was joined by several past and current global leaders, including former U.S. President Bill Clinton and Israeli President Isaac Herzog, in laying wreaths in honor of the victims of the mass killings. In remarks, President Kagame thanked the survivors of the genocide for their effort toward national unity.
We asked you to do the impossible by carrying the burden of reconciliation on your shoulders, and you continue to do so, continue to do the impossible for our nation every single day, and we thank you.
During the 100-day period in 1994, Rwanda's Hutu majority killed more than 800,000 Tutsis and Hutu moderates. The genocide in Rwanda was sparked by hate speech, mostly over the radio, by Hutu extremists against Tutsis. African Union Commission Chairperson Moussa Faki Mahamat also commended the survivors and Rwanda's approach towards justice and reconciliation, encouraging Rwandans to look forward together in unity.
Visitons en émo.
Let's use this opportunity to revisit the journey that you have walked. I am talking about the reconciliation of hearts and spirits and consciences.
Kagame used the opportunity to caution against the increasing involvement of some African countries in tribal politics and potential resurgence of ethnic cleansing.
Rwanda's tragedy is a warning. The process of division and extremism, which leads to genocide, can happen anywhere if left unchecked.
Rwandans will remember their lost families, marking the period with wreath laying, vigils, and peace walks. The period is called Kwibuka, which means to remember. Sena Nutod, VOA, Kigali, Rwanda.
Kenyan doctors have again rejected the government's latest offer to end a nearly month-long strike to demand better pay and improved working conditions. President William Ruto appealed to the doctors on Sunday to reconsider their demand for pay raises because, according to him, the government cannot spend money that it does not have. Dr. Simon Chigundu is president of the Kenya Medical Association. He tells me that the strike will continue until the government completely addresses all of their concerns.
We have immediately rejected. First, even the pronunciation itself is almost illegal because according to the collective bargaining agreement, which is a legal document, medical officer interns are captured in the collective bargaining agreement that has been filed in court. And legally, you cannot reduce the pay of someone. So basically, the interns have been absorbed previously into a civil service job group L, so to speak, and they earn a certain amount of income. So for the president to declare that now they'll be taking a stipend, first, medical interns are actually employees, despite them being under supervision. So they cannot be under the stipend. So already the pronunciation itself is not necessarily legal, and this the union can challenge in court if they proceed to implement that. The second one is that the medical officer interns have been advised not to pick the letters that states there is a stipend, because first of all, that is an affront to the medical profession.
What I see is that the president empathizes with your cause, but he is saying that the country is not prepared to spend money that it doesn't have, and the government is offering 70,000 shillings a month for stipends. Isn't that understandable?
It is not. It is not, because one, the budget for renovations of the state houses can pay medical interns for 1 year. The budget for the expenditure of the vice president can pay medical interns for half a year. If we do not agree that the doctor is the one to take a pay cut for the rest of the country, why can't a pay cut be done for everyone? And anyway, I don't think it will even be a discussion, because the collective bargaining agreement does not allow salaries to be revised downward. And this would constitute a very simple legal case that the government would lose.
Are you trying to equate the renovation to that of the salaries of the intern? Are you saying that the government should not renovate?
Yes, that is not a priority. Training of medical interns is a priority. Renovations can wait.
Dr. Simon Chigundu is the president of the Kenya Medical Association. Kenya Health Secretary, Cabinet Secretary Susan Nakumicha, did not respond to our request for comment. Senegal's new president, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, announced his cabinet over the weekend, comprising 25 ministers and 5 deputy ministers. Senegalese political analyst Ibrahim Akan says there are only 4 women, and one of them, Yassine Fall, is the new foreign minister. However, Khan tells me that the Senegalese women are feeling disappointed with their low rates of representation.
It's a government of technocrats. You have a lot of Senegalese who studied in Senegal and who are really specialists of a number of domains that are concerned now in this government: agriculture, oil and gas, finance, development. And you also have 2 retired generals who also are in charge of internal affairs and defense. The average is young, around 45 to 50, which reflects the will of the population to have young people conducting this new transition in Senegal.
Too often, governments come in and we see that women complain that women representation is less. So what can you tell us about this new government and women?
Well, I think the number first is a problem, because out of 30 ministers and deputy ministers, you have only 4 women. And only 2, in fact, are having an important position: the Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Minister in charge of fisheries. But the rest is the Minister of Family and the Minister of Sport. I think that itself is a big problem, because women were at the forefront in the fight against the third term. Women were at the forefront in trying to protect Sonko and his party. And I even heard today women within the party itself complaining about the way they were treated. The new system should also reflect the reality of the society and the power that women are getting in the Senegalese society.
Who is the new foreign minister now?
The new foreign minister is Yassine Fall. She worked in the UN system at UN Women. Also, her last position, I think, was at UNDP in New York. She's well known in the UN system. And because she knows international relations, I think she will be keen to really, and she's also a well-known Pan-Africanist, she will try to really change the way Senegal will be involved in action related to African issues and also to Africa and the rest of the world issues.
Ibrahim Akan is a Senegalese political analyst. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dakar. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Monday, April 8th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. Yesterday, April 7th, was World Health Day. This year's theme, My Health, My Rights, emphasizes the fundamental connection between health and human rights. The World Health Organization says the right to health for millions of people is increasingly coming under threat worldwide due to issues such as war, diseases, and climate change. Dr. Taiwo Oyelade is a medical officer with the WHO Africa Regional Office. He tells VOA's Lino Mondu this year's theme underscores the critical importance of ensuring that everyone everywhere has access to essential health services without discrimination.
You know, around the world, the right to health of millions of people is increasingly coming under threat. We hear about conflicts, prolonged ones and acute ones, the effect of climate change, the effect of global warming, and all the impacts on health on people. And also, we know that millions of vulnerable and disadvantaged people do not have access to good quality health care. So for this year's World Health Day, the theme, My Health, My Rights, was chosen to champion the right of everyone, everywhere, to good quality health care.
How does the WHO define the right to health, and what are its key components?
The right to health is the right to a set of social arrangements, including institutions, services, systems, and enabling environments that help people to be healthy. The right to health is not only limited to right to health care, it encompasses rights to underlying social determinants of health, including good housing, clean water, energy, security, education, and so on and so forth. And these components of the right to health and the underlying determinants of health must be available in sufficient quantity, be accessible to everyone, financially, geographically, and others, and must be acceptable culturally to everyone. And it must be of good quality, safe, and effective.
What role do governments and policymakers play in ensuring the realization of the right to health for their populations?
Policymakers, they have a most important role to play in that regard. One, they have taken the first bold step by accepting to the treaties and the conventions which are related to right to health. So they have to go a step further. A lot of countries are already doing that, including rights to health in their constitutions and also developing policies and programs integrating human rights-based approach. This should be expanded to cover all the countries. So all countries should have in their instruments, including the constitution, right to health. They should have policies, programs, and strategies towards advancing the right to health. They should also build capacity of individuals and communities in order for them to realize the right to health.
That was Dr. Taiwo Oyelade, medical officer with the WHO Africa Regional Office. He was speaking with my colleague Lino Mondu from Brazzaville, Congo. Israel's prime minister says there will be no ceasefire in Gaza at the six-month mark of Hamas's deadly October 7 attacks. This as international pressure builds against Israel concerning the humanitarian toll of its war against Hamas in Palestinian territories. The U.S. Arash Arabasadi has more.
A speeding car tears through a crowd of demonstrators in Tel Aviv calling for the Israeli government to reach a hostage-freeing deal with Hamas. While elsewhere in Tel Aviv, thousands again took to the streets protesting their government and calling for early elections over its inability so far to secure the release of hostages captured on October 7. It was then, 6 months ago, when the U.S.-designated terror group Hamas and its allies stormed into Israel, killing some 1,200 people and taking hostage more than 250. Israel then declared war on the group, launching air and ground assaults into Gaza, promising to eradicate Hamas. Since then, the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry says Israeli strikes killed more than 33,000 Palestinians. The ministry says another 75,000 suffered injuries. Israel's widespread aerial attacks have leveled much of the civilian infrastructure in Gaza, creating a humanitarian crisis. Israel has rejected accusations of war crimes. The United Nations says famine remains an imminent threat to Gaza. Just last week, the Israel Defense Forces destroyed a humanitarian aid convoy from the World Central Kitchen, despite the group having coordinated its movements with the Israeli military. The charity's founder, Chef Jose Andres, suspended aid operations in Gaza, calling for the Israeli military to do more to safeguard civilians in an active war zone. World Central Kitchen founder Chef Jose Andres on ABC's This Week, as provided by X, the platform formerly known as Twitter.
You can be a friend of Israel, and at the same time, you can be telling your partner in the Middle East, you cannot be conducting war in such a way. You cannot be destroying every building, every hospital, every school, every university. You cannot be destroying, use the future for decades of more than 2 million Palestinians. And in the process, leaving them hungry, leaving them without water, or what is even worse, you shooting them in the middle of the street in the process of trying to have access to food.
World Central Kitchen and Israel's strategic allies called for an immediate and independent investigation into the strike. Israel dismissed two officers in connection with the incident. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the strike tragic, but he remained steadfast in ignoring international calls for a humanitarian ceasefire until Hamas releases all hostages held. Since last week's deadly strike, the White House has said if Israel does not change how it is carrying out its war in Gaza, the U.S. will change its policy toward Israel. Publicly, there remains no plan for an immediate ceasefire, hostage release, or an end to hostilities following more than 180 days of war. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Millions of people in some cities across the United States will today, Monday, experience a total solar eclipse. This is the time when the moon completely blocks off the face of the sun, leading to brief darkness. For a perspective, reporter Gip Dube of VOA Zimbabwe Service reached Dr. Calvin Masilela, a professor of geography and regional planning at Indiana University of Pennsylvania.
Well, in a word, what we're talking about is a very unusual occurrence, at least in North America, what will happen on April the 8th. It's an occurrence that is something like once in a lifetime, total solar eclipse. What that means is that basically you have the shadow of the moon completely covering the sun. And normally what we're used to viewing is a partial solar eclipse. And the way it's going to occur is that the eclipse path will start in the South Pacific Ocean, passing through Mexico, the United States, all the way to Canada. Why is this eclipse unique? It's because most solar eclipses are partial, that is, the sun is part hidden by the moon. Total solar eclipses mean that the moon shadow totally covers the sun. This is rare because the moon's shadow is not big enough normally, and there's a few places on the earth where a total eclipse can happen. North America generally just happened to fall on this unique path. But to be visible, you must be either on the exact path of the eclipse or at least along a narrow band, let's say about 185 kilometers or at least 115 miles of the path. And the actual eclipse, that is its totality, darkness or duration of it, it's somewhere around about 4 minutes and a few seconds. And of course, that depends again on your position on the exact path itself.
Why is it necessary for people to wear those special glasses to look at it?
Well, part of it because it is extremely dangerous to view, at least look at the eclipse without wearing any protective eyewear. Where it's more dangerous, it's when the moon is partially covering, or at least the eclipse is not yet totally full. When it's totally full, you can actually look at it for that period. But as it passes, when it is partially, that's when the intensity of the sun's rays are very, very dangerous to a naked eye. So you have to have protection in order to actually see. Otherwise, you damage your eyesight.
Dr. Calvin Masilela is a professor of geography and regional planning at Indiana University. He was speaking with Gift Dube of View Zimbabwe Service. It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the results of the quarterfinal matches played in the CAF Confederations Cup on Sunday. Defending champions USM Alger secured their spot in the semifinals after defeating Rivers United of Nigeria 2-0 in the second leg of the quarterfinals, winning the tie with an aggregate score of 2-1 to advance to the last four and keep alive their hopes of retaining the title. At the Cairo International Stadium, the Egyptian derby between Zamalek SC and Future FC ended 1-1, as Zamalek were made to sweat in securing passage to the semifinals of the competition thanks to a 3-2 aggregate score, as the first leg saw the former champions coming from behind to snatch a dramatic 2-1 victory over Future away from home to set up what was a closely contested encounter. In Ghana, Dreams Football Club booked their Confederations Cup semifinals ticket after fending off stiff competition from former champions Stade Malien of Mali. Following a 2-1 impressive win away from home in Mali last weekend, the Ghanaians, who are in their maiden CAF interclub competition, came from behind to salvage a 1-1 draw, which sent them through on a 3-2 aggregate score. Away from the CAF Confederations Cup, Namibia's national futsal team coach Rian Jago is determined to get the team to qualify for its first ever Futsal World Cup, scheduled for Uzbekistan in September this year. For the team to qualify, they must finish among the top three in the upcoming Futsal Africa Cup of Nations, scheduled to take place in Morocco, and Coach Jago is ready for the challenge.
As a nation, we can now grow the grassroots side of the game and really build the local leagues and hopefully gain a good following. The better we do, the more children will fall in love with it.
In athletics, Ethiopian Mestawood Fekir excelled on her debut at the distance by winning the Schneider Electric Paris Marathon in 2 hours, 20 minutes, 45 seconds. In a close finish, Fekir won by 3 seconds ahead of fellow Ethiopian Enatnish Tirisiu, who was also making her marathon debut. Kenya's Vivian Cheruiyot, the 2016 Olympic 5,000 meters champion and four-time world champion on the track, was third in 2 hours, 21 minutes, 46 seconds in what was the 40-year-old's first marathon in 4 years. In the male category, another Ethiopian, Mulugeta Umar, took the men's title in 2 hours, 5 minutes, 33 seconds. Umar won the men's race by 15 seconds ahead of Kenya's Titus Kipruto. Elisha Rotich, the course record holder and 2021 winner, was third and came in 2 hours, 6 minutes, 54 seconds. And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a great Monday. And that's it for this Monday, April 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.